And that is self-love. Self-hatred and shame do not motivate anyone to take good care of themselves. However, even people who become incredibly self-loving and attuned to their self-care get sick. No one is always going to be perfectly healthy. As a therapist, I work hard not to judge my clients for their suffering or illnesses. I'm especially careful not to contribute to the double-binding message given to them by society. If they are faultless in their self-care, they will become and stay healthy. Nothing about this message is true. Even if we take excellent care of ourselves, we might experience illness, accidents, or injuries. Regardless, we will age and eventually die. A multitude of factors in life affect our bodies, so it's important to have a grateful, accepting, and forgiving relationship with them. I tell my clients to relate to their bodies in the same way they relate to friends. We don't expect our friends to be perfect or perfectly healthy at all times. We don't punish them when their bodies get injured. We see beauty in their idiosyncratic ways, and we love them as they are. It is the same with ourselves. The goal is to develop respect and love for our own bodies, care for them as best we can, and see their beauty because we love them. A reason for celebration. I really celebrate the person I am. I celebrate others. I look beyond the physical and really get to know people. My relationships with my family, friends, and coworkers, and with myself, have just blossomed because now I no longer see who I am based on numbers on a scale. Lisa T., the Body Positive Advisory Board Member. Becoming your own expert provides you with wise and practical information for living in the body you inherited from your ancestors. While genes mainly determine whether you are big, small, or somewhere in between, it is your lifestyle, how you care for your body in terms of food, movement, rest, and stress reduction, that is the primary determinant of physical well-being. By continually asking the questions, "What do I want?" and "How do I feel?" you hone your ability to know what you require to live with the most radiant health possible, in body, mind, and spirit, for your unique life. So instead of stepping on a scale for information, pay closer attention to your attitudes and how you take care of yourself. Make positive adjustments when necessary, and trust that your body will be what it is meant to be. No struggle necessary. And remember, your body allows you to be here on Earth, which is an excellent reason to celebrate it. Care for it well, and give it love as often as you possibly can. Body positive practices. 1. Explore your body story. The process of becoming the expert of your own body begins by writing what we call your body story. This practice lets you consciously examine the messages, both external and internal, that affect your current day relationship with your body. These can range from something specific, such as a single comment that caused you to feel shame about your body, to something broad, such as the pressure you may have felt from the media's impossible beauty standards, or a childhood centered on someone's insistence that you lose or gain weight. Your story may also include positive communications about self-acceptance. Maybe you had a sibling who taught you the value of being independent, or a parent who honored your creativity. Perhaps a trusted person outside of your family told you they loved you unconditionally, just as you were. You'll discover how you may have internalized messages from the outside world, and how these have turned into a critical or supportive voice of your own. The influences you uncover, whether buried deep or on the surface of consciousness, exert a powerful force on how you exist in your body today. Instructions. You'll begin by drawing your story as a flower, the purpose being that it offers a representation of another living and growing entity. Some people prefer to draw a tree instead. Do whatever feels best to you. Remember, this practice is for you only. You don't have to show it to others unless you want to. So let go of any critical voice you may have about not being an artist. Your drawing can be as simple or complex as you'd like. The purpose is to get you thinking about your body story and provide you with useful insights. Make it fun and creative by having lots of crayons, colored pencils, and/or pens on hand. Roots. Begin by drawing the roots of your flower. Add in, or think about, the primary messages, both positive and negative, you were given about your body from family, friends, your community, TV, magazines, doctors, church, culture, etc., when you were young. What were you told about eating and exercise? What messages did you get about the size and/or shape of your body? Where did you learn what was acceptable and unacceptable regarding your body? Stem. Now, draw the stem of your flower. This is where you will explore your current relationship with your body. What messages do you get from the outside world, including people close to you? How do you speak to yourself about your body? What do you believe about health, weight, eating, and exercise? How do your beliefs influence your self-care practices and your self-talk? Flower. End by drawing the petals of your flower to show where you would like to be in your relationship with your body. What would a peaceful relationship look like? How do you want to feel about your body? How could this relationship blossom? How would having a peaceful relationship with your body create freedom to be more present and engaged in other areas of your life? When you're finished with your drawing, take time to sit with it to see if anything else needs to be added. One way to deepen your experience with this practice is to share it with a trusted person. Ask this person to listen to your story without commenting. Their purpose is to be your witness. Doing this practice from time to time is an excellent way to observe change and growth. If inspired to do so, you can further develop this practice by writing an expanded body story or a poem, creating a painting or collage, etc. Instructions for group practice. If you are in a reading group or other type of community setting, you can do this practice together. Designate one person as timekeeper. A. Draw your flower. As said in the preceding individual practice instructions, take 10 to 15 minutes to draw your flower. B. Share your story. Each pair up with another person and share your story. You and your partner each take 5 minutes to explain your drawing. You can share a particular part of your story that has the most meaning to you in the moment, or give an overview of your whole process. As a listener, do not comment, but pay attention to the parts of the story that resonate with your story and to the things that are new to you. C. Introduce your partner. When you come back together as a group, you introduce your partner by giving their name and one specific part of their story that stood out for you. Before doing this, however, tell your partner which part of the story you want to share and get permission to do so. D. Group discussion. Once you've gone around the circle and everyone has been introduced, take time to discuss what it felt like to be both a storyteller and a listener. Then, explore the ways in which you have all added to the collective body story of our culture. A benefit of doing this practice as a group is that you become aware that everyone has a history with their body that informs how they live their lives and interact with others. This knowledge helps to reduce competition and comparison, because we can remember that everyone has both struggles and triumphs in their relationship with their body. We are not alone. 2. Listening to the wisdom of your body. Learning to sense our health from the inside can be extremely challenging because we are trained to define health by external measures, such as what we weigh, our BMI, and how many servings of vegetables or how much exercise we've had in a particular day. But physical well-being is too complex and individualized to be measured this way. Behaviors and food choices that are widely regarded as healthy may not be right for your particular body. The only way to know what is truly right for you is to learn through trial and error. One way to get in touch with your state of health is to do a simple body scan. Try this awareness/writing meditation to explore what your body feels like from the inside out. Instructions: sit or lie down in a comfortable position. Close your eyes or let them soften, paying particular attention to your breath. Let your awareness float to all parts of your body as you concentrate on internal sensations rather than appearances, numbers, or any shoulds you hold in your mind about what it means to be healthy. Notice any judgments that surface, but try to just observe them without giving them too much attention. Ask yourself, how do I experience my breath in this moment? Does it feel relaxed or tight? Am I able to breathe deeply into my abdomen and fill my lungs all the way up? How do my muscles feel? Do they feel loose, tight, sore, flaccid? Am I holding unnecessary tension in certain muscles? How do the muscles in various parts of my body feel similar or different from one another? What do my bones and the ligaments and tendons that hold them together feel like right now? What sensations are present in my skin? Are these different in different parts of my body? Do I experience my skin as a single organ? How does each internal organ that is housed in my abdomen feel? Can I sense how my intestines are functioning in this moment? My stomach? Other organs? What does my heartbeat feel like right now? Is it calm? Racing? Beating irregularly? How does my breathing affect the way my heart beats? How much am I in touch with my senses? What is my vision like right now? Is my hearing clear or blocked? Is there any sort of taste or texture quality in my mouth? What is happening inside my nose? Is there any scent? Congestion? What is my experience when I rub my hands together and touch my skin? What is the temperature and texture of my skin in various parts of my body? What state of mind am I in? How do I experience myself in relation to my surroundings and the people around me, if I'm not alone? How do I feel being alone? What emotions are surfacing, if any? How does it feel to be still? Do I need to get up and move in this moment? How does it feel if I move around? What kind of movement am I drawn to? Continue to explore your body in any way you would like. Notice the differences between when you sit or lie still and get up and move. Take time to write down what it felt like to consciously pay attention to all parts of your body. As you get in touch with your physical sensations, you become more closely in tune with the responses to the choices you make, recognizing which ones make you feel whole and healthy, and which ones lead to feeling unwell. In this way, you learn to use your internal wisdom to sense your health from the inside out. 3. Exploring the impact of sizeism on self-care and health. As a society, we have slowly begun to stop making assumptions about people based on race, sex, socioeconomic class, gender identity, and sexual orientation. However, sizeism, the hatred, fear, or judgment of others based on the size of their bodies, still runs rampant and unchecked. This form of prejudice continues to exist, even though a person's natural weight, like their height, is mainly a reflection of genetics and does not necessarily indicate anything about their lifestyle, personality, beliefs, or background. It is critical to explore how sizist beliefs and attitudes have affected your self-care behaviors and ultimately your health. This practice allows you to examine the ways in which you may have internalized messages about the size and shape of your body, and the effect this has had on how you relate to and care for yourself. The goal is to become conscious in the face of these beliefs and work to become free so that you can live peacefully in your natural set point weight range. Instructions. Write down the experiences you've had with sizeism, both directly and indirectly, such as comments aimed at you or people in your life. You can also write down your thoughts on societal systems that promote this form of prejudice. Use the following questions to stimulate your exploration. How do you define sizeism? Have you experienced sizeism personally? Witnessed it happening to others? How does sizeism affect people on both ends of the weight spectrum? How does it affect people of all sizes? How is sizeism similar to or different from discrimination based on other physical traits, such as ethnicity, gender, disability, or age? Have you internalized sizeism in a way that affects your physical self-care? If so, in what ways? Have you experienced size privilege? For example, can you walk into most clothing stores and find clothes that fit you? Can you fit in airplane seats easily? Does your doctor not bring up your weight during examinations? If so, what does this feel like? How does it have an impact on your relationship with other people? How does our society promote size discrimination? What do you think about the current societal conversation about obesity? How does or doesn't it contribute to sizeism? Recognizing the problems sizeism may have caused in your life and in the lives of people you love, can you commit to a weight-neutral approach to your health and self-care? What would this mean to you? How, if at all, would your self-care behaviors be modified? Competency 2. Practice intuitive self-care. Goals. Learn to listen to and follow your body's wisdom. Acquire tools and resources to help you eat, exercise, and live intuitively. Benefit. Trust your innate wisdom to guide daily eating, exercise, and life choices. I had become almost robotic in my checklist of life, and it was all about losing weight and maintaining weight loss. Weigh myself, report my weight, write down what I ate, count the points, write down how much I exercised, attend meetings. The emptiness of it all really hit me hard this weekend at the Body Positive Workshop. I'm not going to waste another minute of my life, time, worrying about it. I'm going to trust myself and the inner wisdom of my body and truly listen to it to guide my eating and exercise habits. Cincy S., Body Positive Workshop Participant. Intuitive. Adjective. 1. Having the ability to know or understand things without any proof or evidence. Readily learned or understood. Merriam-Webster.com. 2. Based on what one feels to be true. Oxford American. 3. Prompted by a natural tendency. Dictionary.com. Practice intuitive self-care, the second competency of the Be Body Positive model, offers a way of relating to food, exercise, and rest, and life in general, that encourages you to learn what is right for your unique experience and to find more pleasure in the pursuit of health. As you'll discover, living intuitively heightens all of your physical senses and puts you in touch with the innate wisdom with which you were born, the best guide there is for making all sorts of decisions. It's also about learning from trial and error and being kind to yourself when you make mistakes. You come to honor the life circumstances that make it difficult at times to take care of yourself the way you would like and simply do the best you can in the moment. How little we would expand our knowledge if we never had to come up against situations that offer opportunities to learn from discomfort. As my mom reminds me when I'm struggling with something, remember, Connie, we never learn by doing things right. We have to make mistakes in order to grow. Doing your best to honor your physical needs isn't always going to look the same. For example, if you have a job, buying food is a different experience than if you are unemployed or are living on a tight budget for other reasons. If you have a difficult relationship with food, doing your best might mean allowing yourself to savor one food each day that you usually feel guilty about eating. Getting exercise can be daunting if you live in an environment where the winter weather is harsh, or in a neighborhood where it's not safe to walk alone. Practicing intuitive self-care lets you respond to your body's physical needs and wants while also honoring your current life circumstances. One obstacle that prevents people from trusting their intuition is the thought of being responsible for figuring out what their bodies need. In many ways, this feels harder than having an external, expert voice tell them what to eat and how to move. But playing with the word responsibility makes it much less intimidating. Response-ability simply becomes the ability to respond to the stimuli present. In this case, it is the ability to respond to sensations of hunger or fullness and the need for movement or rest. Adding willingness to the mix, ready, eager, or prepared to do something, positively transforms your relationships with food and exercise even more drastically. When you are willing to adopt this new, intuitive approach to taking care of yourself, then decisions about what, when, and how much to eat, how to move, and when to rest become much easier. You become willing to trust your ability to know what feels good for your unique body, and this infuses your journey with enthusiasm and joy. With more and more research showing a link between happiness and improved physical health, getting enjoyment from self-care creates a win-win situation. Isadel Signore Dresser, Body Positive Leader. My knowledge of intuitive eating began when Connie Subcheck did a training at my high school for students who were starting a group on body image. It was a relief to have someone tell us not to stress so much about good food and bad food, but instead to give our bodies what they asked for, and to be sensitive about listening to internal cues. I have no doubt that my ability to live intuitively changed my college experience. I cannot tell you how many times I heard others around me talking anxiously about dieting, exercising, trying to lose weight, and feeling guilty about the foods they just ate. I watched these poisonous thoughts hinder people's self-confidence and take over their lives. Having the internal sense that I could trust my body, instead of what was going on around me, gave me a protective shield. I knew how to quickly change the subject, or put in my two cents to say that I didn't think diets worked, etc. Even when I fell into the cycle of criticizing my body, my practice of intuitive self-care allowed me to quickly brush away the criticism before it cut me deeply. When I heard others begin their rants and bash their bodies, I immediately tuned out their words and tried to physically get out of the situation. Honestly, not by strict intentions. I have found that I distance myself from those who obsess over food and weight. It is truly harmful to be around this obsession because it spreads like an epidemic. My journey from having bulimia to creating an intuitive relationship with food was unconventional in that I didn't receive therapy until I'd stopped my binge-purge behaviors. In 1981, there was little public awareness about eating disorders and not much support for recovery. Learning how to eat and exercise in balance was up to me. I had been listening to weight loss experts and dieting friends for 9 long years, which had only left me with increased obsession with my body size and the depletion of all things life-affirming. I had no idea what self-care meant, let alone good self-care. All I knew was that I wanted my relationship with my body and food to change. Once I'd committed to healing, I did receive support from a Los Angeles-based therapist named Dee Downs, who sent me a life-saving, isolation-breaking, manila envelope filled with factual information about eating disorders, and most important, one beautifully inspiring story of recovery by Lindsay Hall. Each day I woke up and renewed my vow to become free from my obsession with food and thinness. With my fierce desire to heal and the support of my new friends, I moved fairly quickly to a place where my bulimic behaviors ended. The learning process of what it meant to have a peaceful relationship with food, however, was just beginning. At the time, I knew of no resources to teach me how to become an intuitive eater. I was on my own. At this point, I started therapy with Kim Chernin, author of The Obsession, Reflections on the Tyranny of Slenderness, who offered me a feminist perspective on women's struggles with food and the quest for thinness. I became angry at the societal messages that aggressively promoted a single standard of beauty, a standard that had caused me to spend most of my life seeing ugliness in myself and believing my body wasn't good enough the way it was. I also grieved the loss of my teenage years, when freedom and self-love were stripped from me, because I believed what I was told, that thinness was the answer to every problem in my life. I was ready and willing to take responsibility for what I had done to my body. I chose to rebel against all societal and personal influences that had kept me in a state of suffering. It was time to become my own authority, to learn for myself what was right for me in regard to eating and exercise. Thus began my practice of listening to and following my body's wisdom. My intuitive living practice was difficult at first. Giving up dieting rules was scary. Staying with healing required that I leap off a cliff into the unknown, with faith and trust as my only companions. I struggled with quieting the voices in my brain that were screaming for attention, especially the should voices from my past that were exceptionally loud. What kept me moving forward was the knowledge that I never again wanted to inhabit the prison I'd built for myself with body hatred. My old ways had nearly killed me. I was determined to create a relationship with food and exercise that brought pleasure instead of pain. The biggest challenge was learning to sit with discomfort and fear, and to acknowledge, but not follow, the voices in my head that wanted to numb my feelings. This was not easy. In the past, I had turned to food or obsessive exercise every time I had a difficult feeling. My work was to understand that my fears did not go away by swallowing them or trying to literally run away from them. But facing my worries wasn't as bad as I'd always thought. They seemed to lessen in intensity when I was willing to look at them head on. Solutions to my concerns presented themselves when I was able to sit through this process. So, I learned to listen. And by listening, I mean observing, without judgment, my inner world and the world around me. Instrumental to this practice was developing a set of tools to help me move through the moments when it felt like I wanted to crawl out of my skin to escape myself. One tool I utilized regularly was to get out of my apartment and walk slowly through my neighborhood, paying close attention to the flowers, animals, and people I encountered. Their life force filled me with hope and optimism. I also practiced breathing deeply and paying attention to the sensations in my body when anxiety and stress felt like they were taking over. By sitting still in an observant state of mind, I learned that the tension would eventually pass, and it didn't take as long as I expected. When I couldn't handle the stress of the moment and was in danger of going back to food or compulsive exercise to cope, I reached out to people who believed in me and inspired my bravery. Much of the courage I needed to follow my new wisdom came from the friends I made at the time. Slowly but surely, I was able to discern my true voices of hunger and fullness. By taking time to listen, I could hear my body's requests for certain types of foods, as well as for other needs that weren't related to food at all. I also heard its desperate request to stop running compulsively and find balance in my exercise habits. Listening wasn't enough, though. Trusting the information and acting upon it were next. Looking back, I can see I approached this challenge in the same way I climb a mountain. To get to the top, I merely needed to take the first step. Put one foot in front of the other, and watch where my feet were going in order to move around the obstacles in my path. I needed only to look up from time to time to determine my direction. A cliche, perhaps, but it really is all we can do. In life, we are frequently beginners. It is much easier to take big risks when we honor the unknown and accept that there is always a beginning. Refrain from judging ourselves for what we do not know, and reach out for help if we become lost or afraid. My internal compass led me to the top of the mountain, to a place of true freedom from my eating disorder and body hatred. I can say without doubt that it was worth every ounce of effort it took to get there. Elizabeth, freedom from the shoulds. An added benefit of learning to practice intuitive eating and exercise is that it leads to using your intuition in all aspects of your life. When we trust what we know about the more basic and primitive things, such as knowing when we're hungry and what our bodies crave, we start listening to ourselves on a more subtle level. Our intuitive wisdom becomes available to help us know the deep truth about who we are, what our purpose is, what's right for our lives, and how we feel in relationships. It is a knowing that provides a guidance system to help us live more peacefully, without a lot of ambivalence and confusion. Instead of being preoccupied with what everybody thinks we should do, which is a very troublesome way to figure out what's right for us, we remain attuned to what we know is right for us. We become acquainted with our own truth. No matter how difficult our path may be when we follow our truth, we're not tortured by ambivalence. For example, we may realize we want to pursue a career that is very challenging. If we know in our hearts it is right for us, we have the strength to keep moving towards that goal, no matter what anyone else says about our choice. Teaching people to listen to their inner wisdom fosters purposeful direction. Those who choose to follow their intuitive knowing go forward with the trust and confidence they need to make positive changes in their own lives and in the world. Even though Connie and I originally started the Body Positive to help teens improve their self-care and heal from eating problems, a much greater gift came about. We saw that when people of all ages became free from their preoccupation with food and perfecting their bodies, they tapped into a huge inner resource that allowed them to share their gifts with others. Intuitive eating. When I first started working with the Body Positive, I didn't know if it was possible for me to have a peaceful relationship with food, but I kept listening to everybody else who said it was possible, and that's what I held on to. Asiya A., Body Positive Leader. We come into the world knowing how to eat intuitively. There are, of course, rare exceptions, such as Prader-Willi syndrome, a genetic condition that causes a person to experience a chronic feeling of hunger, and thus to eat beyond physical fullness. Most people, however, are born knowing when they are hungry and how much food leads to satiation. Babies cry when hungry and don't stop until fed. When they are physically full, they will spit out any extra spoonful of food you urge them to take. Elizabeth tells a funny story about trying to overfeed her daughter, Uma, when she was a toddler. As the spoon was coming towards her mouth, Uma looked at Elizabeth and, in true body positive form, said, "But Mama, I'm satisfied." The problem is that along the way, for a variety of reasons, most of us unlearn intuitive eating. The idea that we can trust our bodies to guide us into making positive food choices is totally foreign. Trusting our innate wisdom, especially in making decisions about how to eat, runs counter to what most people, both health professionals and lay people alike, accept as truth. However, the evidence continues to grow in support of intuitive eating as a healthier and more sustainable way to relate to food than restriction and rules. Intuitive eating is different for every person. I know many intuitive eaters, and we all make different food choices. Some of us are omnivores, and others are vegetarians or vegans. Many prefer to eat 3 meals a day, while a number feel better when they eat smaller meals throughout the day. Some avoid certain foods for various reasons, e.g. allergies, religious customs, athletic practices, illnesses, etc. Others eat all foods. Notably, we are all food experts, but for our own bodies only. The nuts and bolts of intuitive eating. Elizabeth and I are frequently asked questions about intuitive eating. Here are the ones we hear most often. Answers are based on the research that supports this approach as a healthful practice and on the experiences of a multitude of individuals who have successfully become intuitive eaters through their work with the body positive. What is intuitive eating? Intuitive eating is the practice of letting your body guide you in choosing what, when, and how much to eat. Eating intuitively means sensing internal signals to figure out what you need, and trusting yourself to make decisions that are both nourishing and satisfying. Rather than relying on external messages to tell you what foods are good or bad, you take time to ask yourself what your body wants in the moment and do your best to give it what it asks for, no matter how your choices are labeled by others. When eating intuitively, you slow down and experiment with food. Appreciating its beauty becomes important. Smell, color, texture, and taste all enhance the experience of your meal. You pay attention to how you feel after consuming different foods and in different amounts. Through this process, you connect with your body in a balanced, healthful, and trusting manner. Eating becomes a practice that has moderation and variety as its core principles, not deprivation. How will I know when I'm hungry or full? Each person has a unique experience of hunger and fullness. Intuitive eating means listening to your own body's cues, not to someone else's rules or suggestions about when, what, or how much you should or shouldn't be eating. For some, hunger feels like a grumbling stomach. For others, it presents as a headache, weak, shaky legs, dizziness, fatigue, or irritability. Fullness can feel like a heaviness in the stomach, but is also apparent when the food you eat starts to lose its flavor and appeal. If you have a hard time recognizing these signs, it may be that you've learned to suppress your body's signals, and eating on a regular schedule, every 3 to 4 hours, will be helpful for a while. If you continue to struggle with over and or under eating, please seek help from a weight-neutral health professional who can assist you in rediscovering your body's internal cues for hunger and satiety. What if I eat too much, don't eat enough, or eat the wrong thing? Intuitive eating is a continual learning experience, a lifelong process of trial and error. It is not a diet. If you eat more or less than feels satisfactory, or if you eat food that causes you discomfort, be kind to yourself. Releasing any guilt you feel for eating beyond fullness, not eating enough to nourish your body, or eating the wrong food will give you valuable knowledge that can be applied to future eating experiences. You use these learning times to stay more closely attuned to what your body truly needs, by knowing how you want to feel when you are done eating, and by remembering the experiences of eating different foods in varying amounts, you develop the ability to make balanced food choices more easily. Beating yourself up for making a mistake doesn't allow for learning, which means it is easier to repeat uncomfortable events in the future. If you sit with your discomfort and forgive yourself for your perceived error, you have a better chance of remembering the bodily sensations or emotions you don't want to repeat. Over time, you'll discover which foods tend to make you feel good and which ones don't. you'll learn how much food to eat to reach a state of well-being, a state that may not always be the same. Experimenting is an important part of the process. Remember that sometimes you'll choose to eat foods that may not make you feel especially great, but you still might want to eat them to enjoy the flavor. For example, spicy food may give you indigestion, but you choose to eat it from time to time because it gives pleasure to your taste buds. Remember, food does not have moral value, and hunger is not a virtue. Your goal with intuitive eating is to have as many nourishing and satisfying experiences as possible. Won't I eat junk food all the time if I don't restrict myself? When you are in the habit of restricting what you eat, allowing yourself the freedom to choose any food you want can be scary. In the beginning of your intuitive eating practice, your body or mind may be drawn to the foods you have been denying yourself. You may find that you eat more of these foods than you think you should. If you are listening closely to what your body is asking for, though, you'll find that your craving for these formerly forbidden foods will lessen just by allowing yourself to have them. Over time, you will restore trust in your ability to make decisions about what and how much to eat. You'll learn what foods and in what amounts feel best, on your tongue, in your stomach, and throughout your whole body. You'll be able to balance the amount you eat of all foods, subsequently removing the need to binge or restrict. It is important to show yourself that you can have the foods you want. As you repeatedly practice eating behaviors that are relevant to your survival, your brain structure will change. Cravings for junk food will lessen, and your desire for more nutritious, wholesome foods will grow. Eventually, you will lose interest in eating when you are not hungry, and you'll no longer be obsessively drawn to forbidden foods. Your ability to nourish your body will improve, and food will no longer hold power over you. What if I'm hungry for something other than food? We all experience hunger for many things other than food. When you find yourself wanting to eat, take a moment to ask yourself, is it food I'm hungry for, or something else? What am I feeling? Boredom, stress, anxiety, grief, anger, loneliness, something else? Do I need solitude? Creativity, community, movement, time to breathe deeply, connection with my spirit, a nap, contact with another person or pet? What obstacles are blocking my ability to meet these needs? Will eating food right now satisfy what it is I'm really hungry for? If it is food you really want, eat it and savor every bite. Remain aware, however, if you are eating to supplant a direct and perhaps more appropriate response to needs other than hunger. We all eat for reasons other than physical hunger sometimes, and that's okay. It can be wonderful to eat foods that give you comfort, excite your taste buds, or remind you of home. If you can be honest with yourself and make decisions from a place of compassion and kindness, without guilt or shame, you are able to fully explore all of your needs. Letting go of justifying or rationalizing your wants and desires makes it easier to have what you want and desire. Food no longer needs to be a substitute for the things in life you crave. You eat for the simple pleasure of eating and bravely take steps towards meeting your other needs in suitable ways. Elizabeth, satisfying your true needs. Sometimes we eat for pleasure. Often we eat to improve a bitter chore, such as making a difficult phone call or balancing the checkbook. A little treat can make a task we don't want to do more tolerable. Eating can be comforting. We all eat for comfort some of the time, and that's perfectly okay. Problems arise, however, when mindless eating happens on a regular basis, or when we eat to satisfy other intrinsic needs, such as for intimacy, safety, or rest. When we eat when we're not hungry, but to meet emotional needs instead, The food makes us feel physically full, while our hearts are left empty and unsatisfied. I help my clients who have unbalanced relationships with food discover their self-love in order to know they deserve to have needs and get them met. Together, we explore that fierce quality of self-love they require to reach out for what it is they're actually hungry for. When you practice eating in a mindful, satisfying way, you will begin to improve your self-care in other parts of your life as well, such as giving yourself permission to follow your desires or ask for your needs to be met in relationships. There are many ways to take care of yourself, and eating is just one of them. I hope eating is a pleasurable and beautiful experience for you. If it's not, if you're eating beyond what your body wants and it's hurting you, or not eating enough to sustain you, then it is time to pay attention to and explore your true needs. If you can't do this work on your own, please seek out a weight-neutral therapist to help. What does doing your best mean? Intuitive eating means doing your best to eat in accordance with what your body wants and needs. It is not about being perfect. It isn't always possible to have exactly what you want, when you want it. We are, after all, mere mortals, and situations occur that limit our control. Do your best to keep a variety of foods on hand. Do you need to bring a snack to class or work so you don't get overly hungry? Can you find a less expensive substitute for the food you crave that will satisfy you in a similar way? Is it possible to shop at your local farmer's market using food stamps? Do you need to take steps to make the foods you want more accessible in your community or for other people not as fortunate as yourself? Be flexible and forgiving when it isn't easy to feed yourself what you want, especially if your budget restricts your choices. Doing your best means you honor your life circumstances when making decisions about how to nourish your body. Let your senses guide you in having the most pleasurable and healthy experience possible, considering the options available to you. Elizabeth. Empowering people to overcome difficult circumstances. I once had the experience of doing workshops at the same homeless shelter 2 years in a row. The first time I went, I was worried that teaching the women about the Be Body Positive competencies wouldn't be relevant to their lives, considering all of the other difficulties they faced. When I returned a year later, I asked the women who had been there previously if what I taught them had been useful. Many said that what they found the most helpful was the information on intuitive eating, listening to their own bodies, and discovering through trial and error what foods were healthy for them. They said that this focus made them feel less helpless in the face of the agendas and advice that came from the staff of the shelter, especially that which was not always relevant to their experience in their bodies. Another message they appreciated was learning they could make positive choices from the limited foods available to them in the shelter cafeteria. One woman commented that since attending my workshop the previous year, she had been concentrating on eating only the cafeteria foods that appealed to her instead of eating those that made her feel bad and then complaining about it. She said she had started saving her food stamp allotment and on Fridays would go to the farmer's market to pick out the most beautiful melon she could find. She would bring her treasure back to the shelter and savor every moment of eating it. In this way, she was able to do what was in her power to improve her health and also to create pleasurable experiences with food, which made her happy. Marissa Ms. Missy Saunders, Body Positive Workshop Participant, Founder, Naya Ministries, and the Express Yourself Support Program. After many years of living an unbalanced lifestyle, I wanted to become healthy but believed it wouldn't be possible due to my lack of finances. I carried with me the myth that healthy eating meant organic, and organic meant expensive. I believed I couldn't afford to be healthy. By the age of 40, however, and after living for years with various health issues, I decided I wanted to improve my chances of living longer, not just for me, but also for my children and the work I had been called to do. That meant I needed to take action. I wasn't exactly sure what taking action meant, but I began seeking out solutions to how I could develop a healthier lifestyle. At the time, I was living on a limited budget that included public assistance and food stamps to supplement my income. Early one Saturday morning, I made my way to the local farmers market and asked various vendors if they accepted food stamps. I was met with smiles and many responses of "Yes, we do." This revelation allowed me to develop a strategy that consisted of finding interesting recipes, planning my meals, writing out shopping lists, cutting coupons, creating a map for my shopping route so I could buy food at several markets, and cooking more at home. By shopping at this farmer's market every week, I was able to use and stretch my limited amount of monthly food stamps for fresh fruits and vegetables, bread, meat, and spices. Because I was there so regularly, I developed relationships with the vendors. They offered me extra items for free, even donating to events I coordinated for my work, and allowed me opportunities to sample new foods. I would then go to several other grocery stores to complete my shopping. Every month, I had enough food to last, which reduced my level of stress. It was a lot of work, and at the beginning, I wondered if it was worth all the time I spent driving around. But at some point, I began to use my shopping time as my me time. It was an opportunity to walk around, which meant I was also getting exercise, look at the colors of the food, meet new people, and exchange ideas and recipes. I began to enjoy the time it took to shop every month. I started to look forward to it. After a year of using this particular strategy, I discovered that I was slowly becoming healthier. My blood pressure that had been high for over 10 years was finally normal, and my diabetes was under control. I realized that my strategy to improve my health was working, and that it was definitely worth the effort it took to make positive changes in my relationship with food. What if I don't like to cook? Cooking is not a pleasurable task for all people. If you don't like to cook, but are the one in your household responsible for making meals, or if you live alone, try to make it a creative experience. Ask friends or go online for easy recipes. Let your eyes take in the numerous colors and shapes in the produce section at the market. See the food as material for an art project. Use your time standing in line at the grocery store to relax your brain. Enjoy a good daydream or people watch. Play your favorite music while you cook. Use chopping time as a way to take out your frustrations of the day, but be careful of your fingers. Talk on the phone with a favorite person. Make extra food so you can have leftovers in your refrigerator. Your dinner tonight can be your lunch tomorrow. If you are cooking for more people than just yourself, create a sense of community by asking others in your household to join you. If you have children, let them participate in meal preparation from time to time. Give them enough autonomy to make it a pleasurable experience for them and you. Talk about the foods you're preparing. Taste the foods as you cook. Engaging children in this process is the best and most fun way to teach them about nutrition. On days when you really can't stand the thought of cooking, try turning whatever's in your fridge and cupboards into a stir-fry or everything meal. If that doesn't work, get takeout or prepared foods. There are lots of nutritious, reasonably priced options these days. If you know nothing about what foods fuel your body and increase its resistance to disease, gather information about basic nutrition. At the same time, experiment with the information to figure out what works for you and what doesn't. Andrea Earle, Connie's mom. I have enjoyed cooking since I was a young girl. Even though I grew up during the Depression, we always ate well, but we never took our food for granted. When I became an adult and got married, it was to our house that people came for reunions and holidays, and the table would be loaded with good food. Even after my children grew up and left home, I still cooked large meals because my husband Bill had a good appetite. He never once forgot to thank me for the food I prepared. When he died, my life changed in many ways. Cooking and eating alone was a big adjustment. I would like to share what I've learned in case it helps someone who has lost a partner or lives alone for other reasons. It was hard at first to figure out how to shop and eat, but I knew it was important to find a new rhythm and routine. I found it especially hard to cut back on the quantities of the foods I purchased. Coming from my Depression-era background, I like a well-stocked cupboard. Breakfast and lunch fell into old patterns, but dinner was another thing. This was the time when Bill and I shared our activities of the day and often played a game of cards afterward. Now I was alone. Dinner had always been a special time for me, and I was determined to keep it so. Since I like to cook and choose to feed myself well, I plan ahead for dinner. I live in the country, so takeout isn't an easy option. I buy smaller quantities of my favorite foods because that way they